You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. What a weekend we had in the Seattle area. We're going to get to the Seattle Women's March and what comes next in just a few minutes. First, we want to talk about what happened on Friday night at University of Washington's Red Square, where protests turned violent. One protester was shot. He's in serious condition. The clash of protesters there on the campus was a response to a controversial speech by the editor for the white nationalist site Breitbart, the provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos. The group that invited him to speak is the UW College Republicans. Its president is Jessie Gamble, and she told me what happened inside Kane Hall after the shooting.
There was a boy, I want to say he was about a row behind me, a few seats over, and the guy yelled out, "Someone's been shot." And everyone kind of stopped for a second to understand what was happening. And we, you know, what happened? Someone was shot outside. And from that point on, I think everyone was unfortunately only half listening because of, you know, everyone was thinking, where do we go from here? How are we going to get out? What's the true situation outside? So I guess that took away from his show just a little bit.
You knew, Jessie, that there would be protests when you brought a very controversial person here. So what did you... What did you come away with when the protests turned violent?
I mean, even before the shooting, we knew that they were violent. We had the police out there who did a tremendous job helping to make sure people got into our event. To my understanding, the students were peaceful. And then as the community started coming in and the Antifa started coming, that's when everything started flipping. And
the Antifa are?
Seattle's anti-fascist movement. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the students, from my understanding, what I saw, the students that I knew who were students there, it seemed very peaceful. And then when the community started coming in and they didn't understand our collegiate atmosphere and just started taking it over, that's when everything really flipped.
Any regrets putting this thing together? You knew there would be protests. You couldn't control them. Any regrets?
No. I mean, in the long run, we had a lot of students come to the event. A lot of students today have told me that for the first time in their collegiate career, even as seniors, that they're going to start speaking up in their class with their conservative principles. And that was really our main goal. And because we were able to inspire 50, and that number's counting, so many students to come out and say, I agree with you, I believe with you, I'm going to speak up, that was worth it.
I got about maybe halfway through the video of Milo's talk. I would say, from what I heard, it was brainless, whiny, radical lefties can't stand to hear ideas they don't like, so they invent victimizing language distortions like hate speech and microaggressions as a way to put their head in the sand and shut conservatives up. That was my summary. What was your summary?
Yeah, that was the first half was a bit of a tirade by Milo, kind of just saying what a lot of us, you know, kind of feel, a lot of us agree, maybe not to the full extent, but kind of it was just to get the crowd on his side. Then he kind of jumped in the latter half with the cyberbullying. And that was really...
What about cyberbullying?
I mean, it was focusing on, people will say a whole bunch of things about you, but those words mean nothing unless you make it mean something to you. And I mean, he said it, of course, in a much more brash way, but it was actually very valuable. It was very beneficial speech in that regard.
So in a way, maybe his line about the Seattle Women's March is thousands of hairy, overweight, lesbian femme squatches wandering around downtown Seattle. He's being a provocateur to say these are just words, people. Is that your idea of his shtick?
I guess that wasn't the main content of his speech, and then it was later that he started talking about more serious stuff with the whole diatribes, the kind of the drama he was talking about. I mean, mostly it was just to get people laughing. It was just to kind of...
He's an entertainer.
Yeah, exactly. It was just to entertain. And again, it's that same type of thing. These words are going to be what you make out of it. And you know, clearly, you know, a lot of brave and bold women still decided to march the next day around the world. It was you know, even though I may not sympathize with them on everything, it was a very impressive thing to see. Especially, I heard about the Seattle Women's March, that by the time the first women in line got to the end of the line, the last of the line hadn't even started their 3.6 mile mark. That was really impressive to hear. So, I mean,
but in Milo's formulation, those are the brainless, oh, poor me, someone I don't like as president. Like that's he makes it sound like that's kind of the worst of America. What is he encouraging? Let me ask you this way. What are you encouraging? Milo, he's come and gone. He doesn't live in Seattle, right? You have attention now. I'm interviewing you because this guy came. So what do you want to say? What do you want to advance?
I mean, exactly what I was talking about earlier with the conservatives on a college campus. I want them to speak up, even if you don't agree with everything that Milo says, even if you don't agree with everything I say, and the whole club, or our whole college Republican club, we all have a different spectrum of conservative ideas. I want you to get involved. I want you to contribute to the dialogue. That was my whole point of bringing Milo here, was you have someone that is really going to break the conversation about free speech wide open, and someone that's going to be very bold and very brash, so that you are inspired to, you know, if he can do that, maybe I can say, I believe this in class. I mean, the bare minimum, bare bones of what you believe, and to do so, even if it may cause scrutiny, even if it may mean you may not make a lot of friends in that class. But from my experience, when I speak up, there's usually another conservative in class that was too worried to say anything.
And what about for you, Jesse? Last time we talked, you were being criticized. You were being called a racist. What's your life like today?
Oh boy. I mean, it's still it still has a lot of bit of tension in my life. After a week talked, a few people, I had got the vague death threats. I got a rape threat. And so because of that, I had a personal police guard throughout the whole Milo event. She's a very nice woman. Her name was Ginger. And she was always like 5 feet or so from me at the whole events. And I've had a few people since then tell me, or at least one, an alumnus told me that I don't deserve to be at the University of Washington. I should transfer out, but I've already applied to graduate, so our degree's still going to say we're at the same place, so bummer. But again, kind of like what Milo's talk focused on is those are just words. If I make them into something, then it's going to be a problem. Then I'm going to dwell on it. Then it's going to manifest into something that's really going to ruin me, but I'm not really taking that all too seriously. I'm focusing on being a student. That's the reason why I came to this school, and I'm so close to being done. I finished in March.
Jesse Gamble, president of the University of Washington College Republicans. Thanks for coming in and talking with us again.
Of course. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. The rapper Kanye West once said George Bush doesn't care about black people. Our next guest says President Trump doesn't even know black America, and that Trump is not alone. His new book is a sermon to white America called Tears We Cannot Stop. The author is Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
You have a lot of white liberal listeners right now in Seattle, Professor. What is your sermon to them?
Well, look, first of all, thanks for the great work. Thanks for your encouraging aspirations over the years. But all of us need to dig a little deeper. All of us can stand to dust off our own, revulsion to innocence that we sometimes claim. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. said the worst enemy of African-American people, black people in the 60s, wasn't the KKK necessarily, but white moderates who felt that they had basically done the right thing and felt self-congratulatory. White liberals, of course, have been far more introspective, but I think we need to push to be a bit more introspective still. How can we think about white privilege in nuanced and, I think, complicated fashion? How do we think deeply and profoundly about the things we have inherited, how race has been shaped and reshaped in America, and how white brothers and sisters don't necessarily get pushed to think about whiteness as a race, but rather, you know, they think of their identities in ethnic terms. And yet whiteness operates, metastasizes across the body politic in some diseased fashion. Can we not look at what's going on with our new administration presidentially and not know that this is whiteness on steroids? This is white innocence that is a captive of the White House, or has made the nation a captive to its own claims, and a kind of resistance to white privilege that is remarkable. So I think white brothers and sisters can do even more to think introspectively about privilege, about innocence, and about challenging other white brothers and sisters to think about this in a strategic fashion.
And we're about to talk more about just that, what else people can do. I want to pick up on what you said about President Trump. What's one specific fear you have that's going to happen under a Trump administration Republican Congress?
Well, this man comes into office as a law and order president. That bodes ill for claims of African-American people that the police are harming and hurting us, that there are rogue cops out there out to do us in, and that the racial profiling of black and brown communities and minority communities will go on without challenge, that the Justice Department will be deaf to the calls and claims of poor black and brown communities. I mean, that's just off the bat what my fear is with him. And then stoking again the vitriol and the vicious hate that has been characteristic of those who have embraced this president. There's no sign in sight that he has gotten the message that, hey, I should tamper down on some of this and tone it down. He's defiant and resistant, and these alternative facts mean that he's, that he's living in an alternative universe, racially speaking, and that doesn't suggest good things for black and brown people.
Let's talk about Trump's predecessor. How much lasting good did President Obama do for black Americans?
Well, look, I mean, he did a great deal for America by, you know, with grace and élan vital and intelligence and graciousness, occupy that office with high intelligence, with literary art. I mean, we miss all those things right now. And the reality is that Obama was a symbolic presence as the first African-American president. But he did some substantive things, some incredible things, especially in the first 2 years. Gave us health care, which we hope won't be totally repealed. Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, which was significant for the lives of millions and millions, up to 20 million people. He bailed out the automobile industry. He put the economy on a much more solid standing. So he did incredible things. But he also failed in ways to address the lasting significance of an enduring presence of racial intolerance and bigotry in our midst. He was slow to the uptake in regard to addressing race, understandably in some cases. You don't want to pigeonhole yourself or ghettoize yourself as the first black president only addressing the black matters. But at the same time, don't avoid them either. Don't go out of your way to, deflect attention to those critical matters. And sometimes I think he did.
So with all of this in mind, I wonder, what do you say, this your book, by the way, we're talking with Professor Michael Eric Dyson, and the book is called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. So here we are in Seattle, and I ask, what do you say to a white liberal Seattle listener who says, look, I voted for Obama twice, I vote to raise my taxes to help the poor, yeah, my neighborhood is either white or it's getting more so, but I don't support official segregation. What more do you want me to do?
Yeah, I feel you. You know, it's tough out here. It's hard out here for a white person. We could say WIMP, whites intelligently, morally positioned. So we could have an acronym for WIMP. But yeah, it's look, what we're asking people to do is go the extra mile. If it doesn't hurt, you ain't doing it real. Right. To appeal to vernacular. If I'm preaching a sermon and it doesn't kind of step on your toes, we're not really preaching, are we? I'm not in your pew yet. So I've got to get to your pew. And if I get to your pew and make you uncomfortable, good. I'm nice. I'm loving. I'm funny. Look at me. I got jokes. I'm not a vicious denunciator of white brothers and sisters, but I'm saying that liberal, you know, pablum has to be strengthened. We got to get off of infamil and get on to some solid food. And solid food is, how do I look at the distribution of wealth? How do I look at black and brown kids who are being disproportionately expelled from school? How do I look at the fact that black women are most likely, and then Latino women, I believe, to be evicted from their buildings? How do I talk about a society where disproportionate numbers of black men and women and brown men or women are incarcerated? So beyond the feel-good self-therapy that can be administered through reaching out to help others by voting for Obama twice, we got to get beyond that, because voting for Hillary Clinton, had she been president, would have been great, but it wouldn't have eradicated sexism. So racism persists. The lethal intensity of it on the local level persists. Can we raise white voices to speak out against it? Can you tweet, or can you Facebook, or can you use your social media platform to say, you know, all this stuff is being said about black and brown people, I got away with stuff that people never jumped on me for in terms of the police system, you know, with a police person or the criminal justice system. And had I been taken to task, I might have had a record too. You know, look, black and brown people are castigated and have moral aspersion cast against them because they were offending, you know, our sensibilities by using crack. But now our kids are caught up on in heroin and addicted to heroin and addicted to meth and the like, and we medicalize it and don't criminalize it. Can we at least interrogate what goes on here? Now, I realize that Washington has, I think, legalized cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, take your medical marijuana as you make these suggestions. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that there are a lot of things that can be done beyond the interior and internal ascent to good feelings and vibrations and doing black people no harm. That's not enough. We got to stretch out and become a bit more involved.
You've touched on a couple of things in your, I think the section in your book was called Benediction.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do about it? And you just touched up, I would say, on school your white brothers and sisters. You just speaking up against injustice. And there are more.
Right.
And before we get to the more, I want to ask about this idea of, you know, enough baby food, enough Enfamil. You know, it's got to hurt a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel about the well-intentioned white liberal? Because it's a conversation we have here in Seattle on KUOW.
Yeah. Look, I think the well-intentioned white liberal is necessary. After this last election, where are the white liberals? Thank you. We don't want to run you away. But we want to say that we got to do more, even more, you know, intelligence, more reflection, more thoughtfulness on a gnarled, complicated problem. And that is, how do we move beyond giving lip service and really trying to make a difference in the lives of people of color? And how can we begin to think differently ourselves about the privileges we possess? Because it's hard enough to get white brothers and sisters to acknowledge privilege, even liberals. And then beyond then, what do you do with that privilege? Do you give it up? Do you surrender it? Do you learn how to share it? Does it make you especially responsible in ways my Bible tells me, and I happen to be an ordained Baptist minister, so forgive me for those who don't even participate in religion or who are not Christian, but to whom much is given, much is required. So what is required of white brothers and sisters? To speak to their own communities, to say, we can't call people names and we can't think about them in deleterious and pernicious fashion. We can't think about them stereotypically. And here we are beating up on them all. They're lazy. They don't want to work, or they got into school because of affirmative action, knowing that mediocre white people get jobs every day. How about the president of the United States of America? I don't want any white brothers and sisters for, I don't know, the next 4 years. There must be a moratorium on complaints about affirmative action, because we have the most historically, I think, incompetent president ever. Now, certainly the most inexperienced. Never had a job as, I don't know, dog catcher. And now you are the president of the United States of America, putting in place, by the way, mostly white men, but a white woman and a black man. Let's consider that the soft bigotry of bro expectations with Mr. Carson. So the reality is this, is that we've got all of these people who don't know what they're doing in jobs of significance that have a tremendous impact on America. And I think that whiteness has covered itself by not even interrogating the incompetence of it, the inefficiency of it, beyond the political and ideological differences that one might have. Those are some of the things that I think we need to be more introspective or at least critical about.
Another on your list was reparations, small r.
Mm-hmm.
You had suggestions. What
right.
reparations are you seeking?
Well, I was saying make reparation, make good, mend the fence. And look, a lot of people are not going to get down with reparations, the serious strategic compensation of people of color, in this case especially black people, for having been denied for a couple 300 years what should have been theirs, systematically stripped of their personhood, their legal standing, their right to own property because they were property, and then when they could, being pushed to the periphery of society. And Jim Crow, during Jim Crow, being denied rights and privileges. I mean, and on and on and on, and being denied education and being denied rightful housing and jobs. So that stuff has to be acknowledged. But a lot of people will say, well, it's too much money. We would break the Bank of America, so to speak, and break the economy and break the national till. So I'm saying, well, we should still push for economic redistribution and for educational opportunity under the notion of reparations. But in the meantime, you can, as an individual person, make reparation. You know, hook up some kid that you know is deserving, who's black or brown, you know, and give them, I don't know, some access to a local museum. if unlike in Washington, D.C., where they're free, they don't have access.
You talk about a film club, film museum club. You could establish that.
You could do that. You could buy a kid a computer. You could reach out and give your lawn man who's cutting your grass a little bit more money. There are all kind of creative individual ways you can make reparation for some of the harm that's been done.
You can hear more from Professor Michael Eric Dyson, the author of Tears We Cannot Stop, because he'll be at Town Hall Seattle at 7:30 tonight. Just a couple more questions, if I may.
Sure.
Over the weekend, there were women's marches across America. The one in Seattle brought out more than 100,000 people.
Wow.
I interviewed a black Seattle woman who said, "Where have you people been?" Do you think white anti, you know, she was, where were you for Black Lives Matter protests, et cetera?
Right.
Do you think, though, that white anti-Trump sentiment helps black Americans?
Well, it leads to an unintended but not unforeseen consequence that people can be helped, that black people can be helped, because now white folk feel the pain, too. You know, people often don't respond until they get it in their gut. You know, if somebody doesn't step on your shoes, you don't get how hard it hurts or much it hurts. If they don't mess up your lawn, you can see that lawns are messed up, but you don't feel the same way when your lawn's messed up. Mm. So, yeah, I think that helps African-American and Latino people. And, yeah, I understand that sentiment, like, yo, we've been out here for a minute doing this stuff. Where y'all been? But, hey, you're late, but glad you're here. And then now that you're hurt and you're mad, think about it. If you're white and pissed at Trump, what do you think we are? What do you think black and brown people are? And look, I was at the march in Los Angeles, California, out there with, what, I don't know, 750,000 people, but let's do a Trumpian a redistribution of numbers. It was
let's argue about who turned out more people, L.A. or Seattle.
Yeah, let's do the Trump numbers. There were probably 7.5 million people in Los Angeles. You just can't tell.
Right.
All right, Sean, Mr. Spicer. So the reality is that, look, what do women prove? A lot of them disagreed. Some are pro-life. Some are not pro-life. Right. Some are choice. Some, you know, are left. Some are, you know, maybe moderate and some right. But they worked it out. They had vigorous disagreements. They didn't come to blows. Women are just better people than men. Hate to say it. I'm a guy. It's good to be a guy. But I'm telling you, I know women can be catty and vicious and name calling and nasty, all that. So can men be. Right. Men gossip more than anybody. But I mean, it's a big secret. Men gossip more than women. Please. I know this is true. So but the reality is, right, who heads TMZ? Who heads the show on Fox? It's all men sitting around gossip and they're leading the way. My point simply is this. Women at their best are better than most other people at bringing us together, trying to come to a place in our society where we can transform what we're confronting here. And that Women's March was extremely important. Yes, they've got to grapple internally with the way in which white women's lives have meant more than black and brown women's lives. But at the end of the day, we've got to find out a way to unify ourselves around common themes of opposition to the oppression that is in the offing with Mr. Trump in the Oval Office.
Final question then for Michael Eric Dyson. Mm-hmm. As we've suggested, we have, because we have discussions like this on KUOW, and I hear from white listeners, some of them who say, we're trying to, yes, what you say is true, but we're trying to move past racial identity politics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find any risk, any line there between doing what needs to be done, but also being mired in racial divisions of the past?
Well, white folk can say that because when they had it to themselves, I didn't hear them complain about no identity politics. When black and brown people weren't a significant number or masses of people to demand their rights, when white folk had it to themselves, the only identity politics they didn't like was, did you like country music or did you like, you know, something that was more so-called orchestrated and European? So the point is that identity has always been at the base of America, but whiteness is rendered invisible. White people are not taught not to think about themselves as a group and also not as a racial grouping and therefore not as white. And they think of themselves as individual. That's white privilege to the max on steroids. And they're not taught to think about the racial identities that they have. So now, even Bernie Sanders on the left says, hey, we got to get beyond identity politics. Why? Because we have to pay attention to the white working class. Get the point? How are you going to get beyond identity politics if you're saying let's pay attention to the white working class? Because there's a black working class and a brown working class. Y'all ain't said nothing about them. They live rural too. The only people who are rural are not white. So rural working class people who were black and brown did not go for Donald Trump. Whiteness is even more significant as an undergirding factor than class or gender. It is the great unifying factor in American society. 54% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Let's deal with the pernicious spread of whiteness and the ways in which white brothers and sisters can help us resist it.
It's in his book, Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Thank you for coming, Professor.
Thanks a lot. Come on out and see me tonight at 7:30 at the Town Hall. Love to talk to you.
Town Hall, Seattle, tonight, 7:30. Now, one of the organizers of the Seattle Women's March said that the march was not the work. That was just the preparation. And she's going to tell you what the actual work is in just a few minutes and what you can do next. So will you do more? What will you do? We're taking your calls. So call us now at 206-543-5869. What's your plan post-March? 206-543-5869. Stay tuned. In case you just tuned in, we've been talking the last few minutes on KUOW about action with Michael Eric Dyson. Did you take action by walking in the Seattle Women's March on Saturday, as more than 100,000 people did? Now what? Will you transfer your marching into more action? And if so, how? Please give us a call right now at 206-543-5869. We're taking your calls in about 5 minutes and talking with a march organizer, too. Call us now, 206-543-5869. But first, what could you do? How could you act if a major tsunami suddenly hit the coast of Washington State? Well, you have a new option now that involves climbing into a spherical aluminum pod. KUOW's Tom Bonsi reports from Ocean Park, Washington, where he spoke with the first American buyer of this technology.
Jeannie Johnson just recently moved from the Seattle area to what she calls her dream home at the beach. It's about midway up the sandy, flat Long Beach Peninsula.
When I decided to move to the ocean, into a tsunami zone, I felt like I should prepare.
Her tsunami evacuation options are not good. She could make a run for it, but this Microsoft executive doubts she could reach the distant high ground in the short time between the end of the shaking of a great earthquake and incoming tsunami waves.
People panic, and I don't want to be caught in the panic.
A bit of internet research led her to a new option, a bright orange, high-strength floating metal ball. She's taken delivery and is now deciding whether to tether her capsule in her herb garden or keep it in the garage. In any case, Johnson wants her dog to join her if and when the big one comes.
Trixie, hop. Come on, baby. Hop. Let's go. Let's go. Hop. Good girl.
My model is big enough for two people to be buckled in like a pilot seat.
So that you're going to get into this sphere.
Yeah.
And it's looks to me a little bit like an astronaut capsule, actually.
It does. It looks a little bit like it came from NASA.
The aircraft-grade aluminum sphere is about 4.5 feet in diameter. It has a round marine door and two tiny portholes.
And I have friends who say, oh my God, wouldn't it be claustrophobic? How can you stand it? And all I can think is, what's my option? To drown. I would rather be in that ball for the ride of my life and maintain my life.
Johnson is the first domestic customer of a startup called Survival Capsule, based near Seattle. Company president Julian Sharp says he got the idea for the product lying awake one night while weekending in Cannon Beach, Oregon.
I thought, well, what happens now if a tsunami comes?
The aerospace engineer had a brainstorm.
And I just thought, well, it's going to be a disaster because I've got 4 sleeping kids. If it comes at night, lights are going to be out. You know, you don't necessarily know where you're going. You can't see the wave, how far it is. So I thought it would be great if I had something I could design, throw the family in and ride it out. And that's where it all started.
Sharp's company's initial sales have been to Japanese customers. 8 capsule kits so far. He anticipates local governments in Japan could become a major customer base, along with private sales along the U.S. West Coast, Gulf Coast, and East Coast.
The target customer is the person who lives on the ocean who cannot vertically or horizontally evacuate.
That's potentially a lot of people, as long as they're willing to pay the price. Sharp says the 2-person survival capsule starts at $13,500. A 4-person model lists for $17,500. Residents who swung by Long Beach City Hall earlier to look at plans for a different evacuation option had mixed reactions to the tsunami capsule idea. Jane Benna shivers at the prospect of sheltering inside while being battered by tsunami debris.
I would hate to be bounced around in that. I'm too old. I'm 80 years old. I don't know that I would care to survive a tsunami.
The city of Long Beach, Washington, is using grant money to design an armored man-made hill that could be used as a tsunami evacuation platform for at least 850 people. Benna favors building that, but as you maybe can tell, she's fatalistic about her own chances. I'm Tom Bonsi on the Long Beach Peninsula.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. A sea of pink hats and picket signs filled the streets of Seattle on Saturday. More than 100,000 people from around the Puget Sound area met at Judkins Park to march to Seattle Center. What began as a Facebook event created by a few women across the country on election night turned into marches in cities all over the world, in fact, with more than 1 million people participating. Now, there were many reasons people marched. Against Donald Trump, for reproductive rights, for immigrant rights, for protecting the environment, and more. But that march is over now. So what next? We're joined now by one of the women who spoke at the march. Anila Afzali is executive director of MAPS Amen, the American Muslim Empowerment Network. Anila, thanks for coming.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Bill.
The city of Seattle said this was the biggest protest march, anyway, in the city's history. Were you surprised by that turnout?
I was delighted to see, I think, something like 175,000 attendees there. It's great to see that kind of strong showing here in Seattle, as well as across the nation. And I looked at it more than not necessarily as a protest march, but as a way to bring people together to talk about social justice and issues that matter to all of us.
That's a good point. I just labeled it a protest march. The marchers didn't label that themselves. I just said it was for and against a whole lot of things.
Yes.
You've said that this march, though, was not the work. The march is not the work. It's just the preparation. What did you mean by that?
Well, I don't want anybody to think that this was their work, that if they showed up to the march, that they did their part. The way I described it was almost like we Muslims, I'm an American Muslim, and we recognize that we pray five times a day. And before our prayers, we do an ablution, a purification. And that purification has benefit in and of itself. But if you don't do the prayer after the purification, you've kind of missed the point. And that's essentially the way I see the march. The march was a step. It was a preparation. It was a launch pad for the actual work. It wasn't the work itself. I'm glad people showed up, including people who had not been active before. It was beautiful to see that. But people now have to take the next step and actually do the work. And that's why it's so critical to make sure people remain engaged, remain active, and actually do things like stand for sort of justice for all in a variety of different ways.
Do you feel that the numbers of people who come out in marches overinflates the actual commitment to do work?
I think we're going to be tested on that. I think that's what remains to be seen. Certainly, historically, that could be true based on what has happened. But I hope we, at least here in Seattle, change that notion. And we actually show that we are committed and engaged beyond just the march, that we do actually use the march as a launch pad, a starting ground for a way for people to get engaged, to do things like speak out against Islamophobia, against racism, stand up for Black Lives Matter, stand with Standing Rock. I mean, there are all these different ways, different causes that are important to all of us. And it's critical for people to look at it as this is our opportunity to really make a strong statement well beyond just that march.
You just mentioned some causes, some issues. What is your advice to help people get from awareness of issues to becoming active?
Yeah. So I specifically spoke about combating Islamophobia. And one of some of the action steps that I mentioned during my words at the rally was essentially people need to meet and get to know Muslims, learn a little bit about Islam, visit a mosque, actually learn about people and make the personal connections. That's an important critical step. Another one is to learn about Islamophobia, understand what it means, understand who these well-funded, small but well-funded anti-Muslim hate groups are that are spreading propaganda, false misinformation, and conspiracy theories about Muslims and Islam, and recognize that and call it out. That's another problem that we're seeing, at least, is people are not willing to call out Islamophobia, and people are not willing to specifically mention American Muslims when they speak about different communities that are being marginalized or oppressed. And then also, most importantly, one of the most effective steps that your listeners can take is to actually speak publicly and vocally about the lives and contributions of the American Muslims they know. Because the majority of Americans, unfortunately, do not personally know a Muslim, and it's easy to dehumanize a community you don't know, a minority community. So that's why it's so critical for people to speak publicly and vocally and use mechanisms like media, like sending letters to the editor. They can send a simple letter to the editor and speak about the lives of the and contributions of the American Muslims that they know. These are concrete steps that people can take. And I have a full action sheet that I hope to share with you guys. And hopefully, Bill, you will post that on the website as well.
It sounds good to me. We're talking about concrete action with Anila Afzali from the MAPS Amen, American Muslim Empowerment Network. And so when that phone actually rings, the mosques, and I say, "Hi, I just heard Anila Afzali tell me to come visit your mosque." Then what, are they ready for that call? What happens next? Is it open invitations?
It is an open invitation. Actually, through MAPS Amen, one of the things I'm going to be doing is organizing open houses.
Okay.
So people will be invited to attend. At least once a quarter, we'll have an open house for people who wish to attend a mosque, who've never been inside a mosque before. They'll have the opportunity to do so. And during that time, me or somebody else will also talk about Islam so they can learn a little bit of basic background on Islam, so that we can actually personalize these marginalized communities and get to know each other and build the relationships, the coalitions, the solidarity that we need for the work ahead of us.
Okay, so there's one concrete action. We're taking your phone calls about your experience at the march and your plan from here on out. We're at 206-543-5869. Judy is in Ballard. Welcome, Judy.
Hi.
What's your plan?
Well, I was at the walk, which I didn't really think of it as a protest, but rather a standing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I handed out flyers that had the White House telephone number, direct line that you can talk to a human being and expand on your concerns to just people as I encountered them.
Not just fellow marchers, but others. You expanded.
Yes, others on the sidewalk watching, and a couple of people in some stores that I passed.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to encourage people to take action.
Okay. Any question, lingering question, Judy?
And I have lots left, so I'm going to be continuing to do that for a while.
Are you a veteran of action, or would you be new to moving to a more active stance?
I'm an old veteran of action.
Uh-huh.
I haven't done anything recently beside the Stop the Iraq War walk that didn't do very much.
Okay, but you're back out in the street and active again. Judy, thank you for that. Thanks for the phone call. 206-543-5869. Peter is in West Seattle. Peter, welcome to KUOW.
Oh, thank you very much.
What is your what was your experience of the march, and what's your action plan? Pardon me?
I've got four basic points I can go quickly.
Yes.
So the one is I really want to focus on actions that strengthen our democratic process and really watch what's going on in the House, Senate, and the Supreme Court, and support what I believe in, and really not pay so much attention to the carnival that goes on around the current administration. I also want to really listen to those who are supporting the current administration so I can really understand and find some objective sort of benchmarks that we can all agree on. And we're gathering as a neighborhood to sort of support each other and show each other how easy it is to take action. And on a daily level, we're using the Indivisible Guide put together by former congressional staffers who took some of the best pages out of the playbook from the Tea Party for leveraging and influencing government.
Model the Tea Party and follow the democratic process, not the carnival, and listen to Trump supporters and gather with neighbors. That's a good list, Peter in West Seattle. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Thanks for holding this program.
And Bill, I would just add that there are these neighborhood action coalitions that are created across Seattle right now, the greater Seattle area, and that's a perfect way for people to get involved and remain engaged beyond just yesterday's march or Saturday's march.
Sometimes, Anila, we hear from listeners who say, you are catastrophizing a Trump presidency that hasn't even begun yet. Is that fair? And are you mindful of exaggeration?
So as an American Muslim, I say that my focus is not Trump. The problems that we have been facing as a community have existed far before Trump came into the picture. So this is an ongoing, a continuation of the work that we need to do. Certainly a Trump victory has awoken other people and made people, incentivize people to actually take action right now, especially when they see Muslims along with other minority communities being marginalized, attacked, or specifically targeted for certain actions that go against our shared American values. So we see that incentive among other people. And even within our own American Muslim community, we have that right now. But I say this problem far, you know, that became was in existence before Trump, and it may continue beyond him unless we take action. And that's why it's so crucial for people to take action. And I will say that even at the march, I had so many people come up to me, especially after I gave my speech. People came up to me. People came crying to me even and said that they had not been aware about the situation of American Muslims. They had not thought about that even. So it was really an eye-opening experience for them to even hear my words. And that was beautiful to hear. And they've made a commitment, and I hope they will stick with their commitment to actually take action now, because the first step is being awoken to the situation. And I think a Trump election victory has done that. It has awoken certain people that might not have been awoke before.
We're at 206-543-5869. Deborah in Bellevue, were you at the Seattle Women's March?
Alas, I was not, because I was being chaperone and driver for my mom, but I was walking in spirit, and I know that many of my friends had my name in their pockets, but I've got an idea for what to do moving forward.
We're ready.
Well, I would like, because I'm such an avid walker, I want to walk weekly with a group of people that want to get together for the sake of walking and discussing how to keep the spirit and the energy and actively do things alive. So I'm going to start in Bellevue. I live in the Crossroads area, but there's Green Lake, and there's Marymore, and there's, I mean, every neighborhood has a place, and we can gather, and we can walk, and we can get to know people we don't know, get some exercise, and keep the spirit alive so that regardless of the weather and the time of year, we're doing something as women, men, to maintain the energy of the walk, which I would have loved to have been a part of, and I was in my way.
Yeah, that's interesting, because notice how much media attention, including right now, a walk, something happening physical outside where we can see it, gets. How do you alert the media or your fellow travelers that there is there's an umbrella reason for this, all the walking that's going around? I mean, people walk around Green Lake all the time. How do you galvanize that visibility of a walk?
Well, I'm going to use Meetup, and I'm going to use Facebook. And I'm going to use Eventbrite so that it can be, and hopefully people who would like to organize in their neighborhoods would reach out and say, I'll take my neighborhood, and if they want to do it. And I've got a friend who was up here this weekend. She's going to take it back to California and San Francisco, where she lives. So this is something where we can decentralize, and we can keep the spirit and feet moving, and we'll make friends we didn't have, and we can continue to galvanize, and we can also use the existing social platforms to not just be on the social media platform, but be physically getting together.
Deborah, thanks so much for your call. That's Deborah from the Crossroads area of Bellevue. We began this conversation, but we've been talking, by the way, with the executive director of MAPS Amen, the American Muslim Empowerment Network, Anila Afzali. You began this conversation by saying that this weekend's Seattle Women's March wasn't the work, it was more like the preparation. Mm-hmm. So how much actual value is there in Deborah's enthusiastic idea of continuing to walk?
I mean, I love that people are wanting to continue the effort and the walk. But what I would love to see is people to also translate that into calling their representatives, getting engaged, writing letters to the editor, and also even if they are going to do the walk, that they include minority voices, which oftentimes are marginalized. And if it's a lot of sort of groups of, let's say, white people just marching on their own and not having marginalized voices included, then they may not sort of benefit from sort of the experience. Experiences, voices, messages of what we have to share.
And how would they do that? How would they reach out? If they don't already know those people of color, how do they reach out to them for this walk?
Well, for starters, if they want to walk and actually reach out to minority communities, one great way to do it is to show up to events like Black Lives Matters walks or movements or gatherings or, you know, a May Day parade or a Standing Rock event. So attending events where minority communities have been involved at the forefront of these kinds of movements, where unfortunately we don't have, you know, 100,000 white women showing up to these kinds of events. And it would be great if we did have more of that solidarity built and having more of our white sisters and brothers showing up to these other events as well. They can meet people there and then they can continue the conversation and remain engaged that way as well.
There's another concrete action you can take now that the Seattle Women's March is history and we move forward from here. Anila Afzali, Executive Director of MAPS Amen, the American Muslim Empowerment Network. Thanks for she's by the way, she spoke at that march over the weekend, and we're glad you've come into the studio with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill, for having me.
This is KUOW's The Record. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. So President Trump wants to bring back American jobs with tougher trade deals and rebuilding our manufacturing base. But former President Obama says the real threat to jobs is technology and automation. Technology, automation. Where does that happen a lot? Hi, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
Good, good. Todd Bishop is the co-founder of the Seattle tech news website, GeekWire, and we talk so much about the promise of technology and automation, and let's do that, but let's also talk about whether there's a threat. Will you start by reminding us how much tech jobs have remade our city?
Absolutely. We just had a report today talking about Amazon and its impact specifically on the office market. Of course, we talk a lot about residential and its impact on the housing market as these new employees come in. But Amazon now occupies about 20% of the office space in Seattle, and it's going to grow even more. It's going to get up to about 12 million square feet in Seattle over the next few years. Mm-hmm. And so this is a company with a strong foothold here. They just announced recently they're going to be hiring quite a few more people, adding 100,000 more jobs in the U.S. over the next 18 months, which is a 55% increase in their workforce in the country. So a lot of that's going to happen here in Seattle.
And those commercial leases in Seattle, how long do those leases run?
You know, they really vary. It can go anywhere from 5 to 10 or sometimes more.
You know where I'm going with that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the question is, when is this going to end?
Yes.
And the answer is, at least in terms of Amazon, they have shown a remarkable ability to continually reinvent themselves and ignite new growth. Amazon Web Services, their new push into grocery, and also their warehouses, which is one of the front lines for this entire discussion about automation.
Yes, but I doubt that the goal of the Amazon leadership is to boost the fortunes of the people of Seattle, right? Their goal is to cut costs and make money, and it's not necessarily here.
That's right. They are a company that has expanded globally. They now employ more than 306,000 people. We'll actually get an update on that number in a couple weeks when they report earnings. But a lot of that growth has happened in their distribution centers around the world. So it's not just here. They employ about 40,000 people currently in Washington State.
Part of the reason you cite in your reporting that Amazon and other companies, tech companies, are attracted here is that we're, believe it or not, still cheaper than Silicon Valley.
That's right, especially if you look at office rates and, of course, the whole income tax issue. We still are at about, you know, half the level of lease rate that a company would pay if they went to Silicon Valley or New York. So there is a certain attraction here. And even in the housing market, as much as housing values have gone up here, we are not yet on the level of Silicon Valley. So that is creating a lot of incentive for people and companies to relocate here.
But doesn't that also mean that when we get less and less affordable and some other town is the next cheaper hub, then see ya? Or is there something that Amazon, remember when Seattle left, or rather Boeing left Seattle right. for Chicago? I mean, how invested do you think Amazon and these other tech companies are in this town?
Amazon in particular seems to be walking the walk here. They are focusing heavily on the urban core and building up their existing presence here in Seattle. Our reporter Nat Levy had a long report today on just how much Amazon is investing here in terms of real estate.
Okay, then now let's get back to our premise, which was former President Obama warning about automation. We've said that some of the companies who are providing this automation and this artificial intelligence, the Seattle area benefits because they're doing well here. But will automation begin to hurt our larger economy by killing physical retailers and the jobs of other industries as they get roboticized?
Yes. In fact, there's a report out from Forrester, the research firm, that says about 6% of all U.S. jobs will be eliminated by 2021, so in just about 5 years. And so that is a big concern. However, most of those jobs are lower paying jobs, things that can be easily automated. Trucking is a big point of potential vulnerability to automation if you look at it from the human perspective, mm-hmm. opportunity from the business perspective mm-hmm. to cut costs and create more efficiency. So those lower level jobs are the ones that are going to be taken over first. So this is why retraining is so important. Alan Boyle, our aerospace and science editor, has done a lot of research into this, and he says that this retraining efforts to make sure that the people who are having their jobs displaced are getting those higher level jobs, that's what's going to happen over the next 50 years in the economy.
How much of that retraining is happening in the private sector, and how much do you think a Trump administration is going to spend on retraining?
It's a combination of the two. You see a lot of different companies, Microsoft, Amazon, have their own internal programs to help people find new jobs. Amazon has training programs for their distribution center workers to go find jobs elsewhere, like outside of Amazon. So they are heavily invested in this, which is an interesting point. Hmm. It does take some government support, though. So that is a very open question. It'll be interesting to see what happens to that in the Trump administration. I don't think anybody can give you an answer at this point on that.
Right. And of course, it's not just the federal government, but it's your state and local governments. And we'll keep following this with Todd Bishop, co-founder of GeekWire. Always good to talk with you, Todd. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. Make sure you get a podcast of this program. You never miss a show when you subscribe, whether it's at KUOW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join the conversation online. We're tweeting at KUOW.